You know, it was funny. The reason I decided to do James, as a matter of fact, was mainly because when I did Kierkegaard, whom I'm not all that impressed with, as you know, a lot of people really liked Kierkegaard. And so, you know, William James is similar, I'd say. And so I thought, well, gee whiz, they really like James. That's why I decided to do it, really. Aside from the fact that I had never done it in the past, and it was a chance to, you know, get a little more familiar with something that I was marginally familiar with before. That's been the great thing about this Sunday school class. I mean, it allows me to explore things that I've wanted to explore for some time and maybe not had a chance to. I have all these things in my head that I want to do. There are three ancient authors who have survived. Well, they sort of pieced them together, who were opposed to Christianity. One of them being Julian the Apostate, Porphyry, and the other one being Celsus. And so I have all that stuff. I've never read it and studied it, but I thought that would be kind of interesting to see what contemporaries in the ancient world thought about Christianity. That would be interesting, too. And I just have tons of ideas.
That would be definitely cool. I hope for that.
I have lots of ideas I'd like to do. And,
well, Don, as I said, Peirce and James are not hard to read. I'll give them.
Yeah. Well, compared to some of the Peirce you read is not hard. most of Peirce is pretty technical, but you're right. Those, especially those two essays.
The thing written in Popular Science.
Yeah.
Which is what I.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And James. Well, no, James is always readable. As a matter of fact,
you know, I can see how James would be a good college professor.
Oh yeah.
As a lecturer.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, rather than just going from memory, I actually wrote down. Remember, we're doing six works. It's not everything he wrote, of course. I maybe should add this later, but he wrote some works in psychology because he was a.
Right.
I mean, his chair was professor of psychology and philosophy or whatever. Of the six we're doing, you know, remember three I classified as pragmatic theory, and three I've classified as philosophy of religion. And I keep on saying, well, you know, I think, you know, this and this, I think were lectures, and this, you know, well, so I wrote it down, and I also wrote down the date. So of the six, pragmatism, of the three theoretical ones, put it that way, pragmatism is the earliest, and that was a series of lectures given at the Lowell Institute and Columbia University. So that was here in the U.S., Northeast. And then The Meaning of Truth, which was the second thing, that was in 1909, 2 years later. And that's nothing but a collection of essays. You know, it's interesting. Of the six works we will have reviewed, only one was written as a book.
Right.
Two of them are collections of essays, and three of them are lectures that he gave at various times, you know. The only book is the last one, Some Problems of Philosophy, which he was working on at his death. He died in 1910. So The Problems of Philosophy actually came out in 1911, so right after his death. And then the Philosophy of Religion ones go. The Will to Believe is by far the earliest of any of the six works that we're covering, and that was 1897. And of course, that one also is nothing but a collection of essays, the lead essay, of course, being The Will to Believe, right? We'll finish that up today. I'm pretty sure we'll finish that up today. Making sure I brought the right book. That would be a disaster, wouldn't it? The Varieties of Religious Experience is a well-known work of his as well. It's the kind of half philosophy, half psychology, half history, I'd say. Well, there you go, one and a half. 1902. And those were the Gifford lectures delivered at Edinburgh. So this is a second set of lectures. And then A Pluralistic Universe are the Hibbert lectures given at Manchester College. So that also is a series of lectures. So
Manchester, England?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, as Tom said, you know, he was a Well, I've read elsewhere that he was very much of a people person. You know, he's very gregarious, and I think that helps. And obviously, reading his stuff, he is a vivid writer, even if a bit unclear at times, but at least a vivid writer, and thus would be, I would think, a very popular figure on the lecture circuit, as is confirmed by the fact that half of the works we will have covered are lecture notes, you know? Well, anyway, so once again, this is the last, I'm sure the last time we'll talk about The Will to Believe, keep in mind that it's 10 pieces altogether, 10 essays altogether, and I have divided them up into 7 in concerning belief and 3 concerning questions about free will, determinism, that sort of stuff. And it's the first group that I guess are certainly the more famous, and we spent more time on that than anything else. In fact, we just barely started the other part last week. But I'll just remind you right now, altogether, I count, 5 arguments. This is the last time I'm going to say this. 5 arguments for religious belief, according to William James. And the way I divided it up is the will to believe is the Pascal wager update, you might say, which is what's on the board there. And then it was, is life worth living in the sentiment of rationality? Those two are the ones that center around the idea that belief actually can affect how successfully, or can sometimes succeeding in something is dependent on your believing that you will succeed. And remember, both of those essays contain that example about jumping over a chasm. Have I ever told you the Ross motto? Have I mentioned that in class here? The Ross family motto.
Well, if Marty doesn't know it, then you haven't.
Well, I don't know. Does Marty know the Ross family motto?
Because she's known you forever.
I guess not.
I don't think so.
Okay, well, the Ross family motto is success breeds hope.
Okay.
Isn't that a downer? Success breeds hope.
Where does that come from?
I don't know. But that's just what's out there. So that makes it sound like if you're successful, maybe there's hope.
Right.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah.
I feel like it should be the other way around.
Yeah. I know.
Is and that on your family shield or something? I thought this was something you made up.
No. It's on the family crest.
In Greek.
That's what it means.
No, it's in Latin. It's in Latin. Maybe the person didn't know Latin and switched the nominative and accusative cases. I don't know. But yeah, it has this, it's a picture of an arm holding up a wreath with, I don't know, rampant lions around or something, I forget. But down below is spem successus alit, which means success breeds hope. So I've never quite been able to, but anyway, that's the opposite then of believing you're going to jump over the chasm. A Ross would never do that. If the Ross managed to leap over the chasm successfully, I guess that person would think, well, maybe possibly the next time I'll be able to do it also.
Remember, Don, hope is not a strategy.
Yeah, exactly. Although, I here's my theory. So, space, S-P-E-S, spes, in space in Latin, in Augustine, is in earlier Latin, it really means more expectation, I think, than hope in English. So I'm thinking, number one, and maybe they just got their nominative and accusative cases mixed up, and so maybe it really means, expectation breeds success. Now that would be much more positive, wouldn't it?
Yep.
And that's much more Jamesian. Anyway, being able to jump over that, I expect that I'm going to be able to do it, and darned if I don't do it. That would be very Jamesian. So. But anyway, that's argument number 2, and that's in those 2 essays. And then argument number 3 was the most important. The one that is somewhere. Where is it? Oh, yeah, over there. If there's nothing else that if I were teaching James's theory of pragmatism, I would also assign that particular essay, because that's the one that where he adds to the sort of the normal logical positivist type criteria, perception and thinking, this willing thing, and that's also is one of the things that provides evidence in this weaker sense that James wants to advocate. So that really does, I think, very nicely flesh out what he means in the theoretical works. And then the fourth argument, remember, was the moral argument. And at the funeral yesterday, that popped up again, right? Somebody mentioned...
And they mentioned C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah, they mentioned C.S. Lewis. That was what I was trying to remember. Yeah, that's right. And it was his son, what was his name?
He was a Baptist preacher, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Jack, was that his name? I forget. But anyway, yeah, and he mentioned that very argument from C.S. Lewis, actually. And then the last one is the one that I said is very Neoplatonic. That's in some Hegelisms. The moral philosophy and the moral life is the moral argument. Some Hegelisms and what psychical research has accomplished is the fifth argument. So anyway, last time we began talking about the other three essays in The Will to Believe having to do with determinism, and James seems to think that, and this is as far as we got, James seems to think that a determinist is... Well, I put it this way. Determinism, per se, is an incoherent position, because the determinist is denying that you have the right to make any value judgments, because what will be, and that's just the way it is. So what's the point of making a value judgment when it's just a fact, you know? And yet, says James... determinism can't avoid in stating that principle to can't avoid making value judgments him or herself. in saying you shouldn't be making any value judgments about things, because what is and what was and what will be, in saying that word shouldn't is also making a value judgment. And so in a way, so says William James anyway, the determinist is being self-contradictory, right, and making a value judgment and stating that you shouldn't be making any value judgments. So therefore, says William James, determinism is incoherent, and thus we have to introduce the idea of free will. That's the first argument. There are three arguments, according as I count them. And by the way, that's in the Dilemma of Determinism, of course. Also in the Dilemma of Determinism is the next argument we're going to talk about in just a second. And the other topic having to do with the individual and society. There are two other... I didn't write anything for the importance of individuals, but I guess you could lump it in with great men and their environment. So the first argument, or the first two arguments, come from the Dilemma of Determinism. You'd enjoy that too, by the way. It's well written. And then the other... The last thing I'm going to talk about is from the other two essays in this group of three. So anyway, so after he talks about... question is which color. I think I'm on this color. After he talks about... Yes. After he talks about the so-called incoherence of... See, I'm not convinced. That's why I keep on saying according to James and so-called and that. I'm not convinced that the determinist has to be inconsistent and has to actually say you should do this, you should, you know, you should not make value judgments. I think it's logically possible for a determinist to be totally to shun should language altogether, in which case there would be no inconsistency. So I'm not sure James is right on that, but anyway, he brings up yet another topic toward the end of the Dilemma of Determinism, and this is what I want to read you. And this is very interesting, actually. This is pretty good. And this is all about, as long as he's talking about causation and free will and that sort of thing, a related issue is providence. In other words, God's well, God's benevolent governance of the universe, that ultimately, well, you know, that the hymn I keep on quoting, "This is my Father's world," you know, the last verse of it, which I never can remember how it starts off. "This is my Father's world. Oh, let me ne'er forget that though the wrong be oft so strong, God is the ruler yet. This is my Father's world. Why should my heart be sad? The Lord is king, let the heavens ring. God reigns, let the earth be glad." That's how it goes. Well, that's a really nice expression of providence, right? God is in charge. Things may seem bleak, but at least there is hope, if I can bring that word up again. There is hope because, you know, the Lord reigns, let the Lord is king, let the heavens ring. God reigns, let the earth be glad, right? So that's providence. Now, here's the question. Here's the thing. Let's think about providence in Islam, which we talked about, of course, a lot last year. And providence in Islam, well, maybe I shouldn't just say Islam, because Islam is very varied, as you know. But providence in Al-Ghazali, who is, I think, the most possibly the most interesting Islamic thinker. Well, providence in Al-Ghazali is God's absolute predestination of everything. I mean, and the tradition that Al-Ghazali belonged to, of course, as I've mentioned many times, God is recreating every atom of, or repopulating every populated atom of space at every atom of time. So in other words, time, space and time are both discrete and not continuous. In other words, there are minima of space and minima of time. And at every minimum of time, God is filling up those minima of space that bodies occupy, you know, and the ones that they don't occupy just remain empty, of course. Well, that means that God is in control of everything. And I have, twice at least before, I have invoked that horrible tragedy in Afghanistan, where we, after that bombing at the airport, and we destroyed what we thought at the time was a hostile vehicle, and turned out to be a guy who'd worked with us, with some of his family, you know. And the wife was, to my mind, just amazingly, I don't know, I mean, amazingly resigned, I guess. I mean, her attitude was, and this is Al-Ghazali, even, or at least the Asharite theology percolating into the 21st century. You know, their time was up. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the book was written by God. It's up there in heaven. And who am I to question what God has decided?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Thinking back to when we covered that.
Yeah.
Whether he was arguing that God had decided things off into the timeless future,
mm-hmm.
and was merely executing
them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Or that God could...
Oh, I see.
The spur of the moment. Change his mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, if you look
at... Before doing the predetermination.
If you look at the occasionalistic argument, which is this argument about recreating everything at every instant,
yeah.
and all that, it sounds like God could just on the spur of the moment say, well, I think I'm going to do things a little differently this time or something like
yeah,
that.
I don't recall.
However, if you have this idea of the book, or at least as far as human lives go, which is a little different maybe from all the details of a drop of magic marker and so forth, that wouldn't be in the book, I presume, but if the book contains, you know, the birth and death date, say,
yeah,
of
like
all,
when did God decide your time was up?
Yeah, then that
before
would be,
you were even born.
That would be, well, no, then that would have been from all eternity. See,
yeah.
So maybe some are, some aren't. That's
so people can go either way on that question.
Yeah,
okay.
But either way, it's God's decision, and who am I to question God's decisions? You know, well, anyway, so. In that extreme form, you see, providence is tied in with complete predestination. Now, James is going to argue, though, and this is what's interesting about it. I think you'll really find this argument interesting. He's going to argue that you don't have to adopt that extreme view of predestination in order to sustain this idea of divine providence. So that's a long introduction to what I'm going to read you. This is about, I don't know, four or five paragraphs worth, but it's easy to understand and interesting. But now you will bring up your final doubt, he says. This, like I said, this is right at the very end of the essay. Does not the admission of such an unguaranteed chance or freedom preclude utterly the notion of providence governing the world? In other words, do we have to choose between complete and utter freedom and no providence, or complete and utter determinism, predestination and all that, and providence, right? Is it one or the other? Freedom here or providence here? No, there's room in the middle here, and that's where he's going. Does it not leave the fate of the universe at the mercy of the chance possibilities and so far insecure? Does it not, in short, deny the craving of our nature for an ultimate peace behind all tempests, for a blue zenith above all clouds? To this, my answer must be very brief. Well, it's not all that brief, but it's reasonably brief, I suppose. The belief in free will is not in the least incompatible with the belief in providence, provided you do not restrict the providence to fulminating nothing but fatal decrees, i.e. al-Ghazali. If you allow him to provide possibilities as well as actualities to the universe, and to carry on his own thinking in those two categories just as we do ours, chances may be there, uncontrolled even by him, and the course of the universe be really ambiguous, and yet the end of all things may be just what he intended it to be from all eternity. And you say, okay, wait a minute now, how's that going to work? So you're saying that it's neither the case that there is total free will and God has no control whatsoever because everything is free, nor is it the case that everything is fated, determined, predestined from eternity by God in order to ensure providence. But we can still have providence if there is ambiguity and chance and unpredictability in the universe. How is that possible? He's going to tell you. And this is clever, I think.
I'm bored with humans today, so do what you want.
No, this is, here's
hey,
an,
that
here's
an answer.
He gives us an analogy. An analogy will make the meaning of this clear. Suppose two men before a chessboard. The one a novice, the other an expert player of the game. I bet you know where he's going once he says that. The expert intends to beat, but he cannot foresee exactly what any one actual move of his adversary may be. He knows, however, all the possible moves of the latter, and he knows in advance how to meet each of them by a move of his own, which leads in the direction of victory. And the victory infallibly arrives after no matter how devious a course, in the one predestined form of checkmate to the novice's king. Let now the novice stand for us finite free agents, and the expert for the infinite mind in which the universe lies. Suppose the latter to be thinking out his universe before he actually creates it. Suppose him to say, I will lead things to a certain end, but I will not now decide on all the ways thereto. At various points, ambiguous possibilities shall be left open, either of which at any given instant may become actual. But whichever branch of these bifurcations become real, I know what I shall do at the next bifurcation to keep things from drifting away from the final result I intend. So God is this master, this grand master, this universal grand master, and leaves open various things, but being the universal grand master, God always knows how to counter the moves to get to the goal that God intends is the idea.
You mean like, okay, kids, go off and play for a while, and I'll come back and check on you later?
No, I don't think it's that. No.
I mean, that's...
No, but I mean, it certainly entails a certain amount of intervention. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I mean, the grand master playing the chip is going to move the piece, right? So it's not a hands off kind of thing. It's simply that God allows free choices among people. In other words, this is the anti Al Ghazali, right? Al Ghazali is way over here on this extreme here. Everything is scripted by God. Or think about the Bhagavad Gita. It's the same kind of thing. You know, everything is scripted. That's not what's going on. There's free will out there, but God knows how to deal with it and to bring things along to the ultimate victory that God intends. It's the idea, right? It's like, here's another more homely analogy. Back when I started teaching, I used to be more Socratic than I am now. This just wasn't my style, I guess. But I was trying to be, you know, imitate Socrates. And so I was trying to get the class to a certain goal, but I couldn't predict what somebody was going to say. And I had to try to think fast in order to respond appropriately to get the discussion back on the whichever direction I wanted it to go in. I was so impressed, by the way, by one of my teachers at Iowa, who was really good at that. Butrov is Payinot, P-A-Y-N-O-T, I think is how he was Bulgarian. Butrov, he had fled communist Bulgaria and so forth and so on. Well, anyway, he was fabulous. I mean, he was such a brilliant teacher. And he'd stand up there like this, with his arms straight out and his Bulgarian accent, and engage the class in this Socratic dialogue. And no matter what we said, almost, he'd know the answer to it. Wow. Because he had studied, it was on analyticity. It was a type of topic, which is analytic synthetic distinction. What is it that makes analytic propositions analytic? And he knew the literature and all the he knew all the arguments, basically. And so no matter what you said, he'd be able to say the appropriate response, you know, wherever he was going with it. So I was so much in love with that when I started teaching, I tried to imitate it. So I have some feeling for that, you know. But unfortunately, I'm not a quick thinker. Yeah, Gladys.
The story you have just related, there is one part which I think it's very, very meaningful when you're teaching, is that if you do have an accent, people need to focus far more to be able to understand you.
Oh, yeah.
That if you don't, because if you don't, people can just fall asleep if you want, you know, not fall asleep, but, yeah, I don't have to make an effort.
Exactly.
And that is a plus in trying to keep, students
alive, alert, and
pay attention to what you're saying.
Yeah,
otherwise they won't understand.
Yeah. Well, I've noticed, by the way, now that you mentioned that, this is a little off the subject, but I think Hero is very good at being understandable. In fact, I can understand her amazingly, better than Jenny, because Jenny had a bad habit of trailing off at the end of the sentence.
Right.
And you get to the end of the sentence, what was that? It's just the way she talks, and it's fine if you're just talking one-on-one, but if you're speaking publicly. Mm-hmm. But of course, Hero is very conscious of that because she's a native speaker of Korean, so she's really conscious of that. So she tries, I think, extra hard to enunciate clear and to speak slowly and to project. Those are the three things.
But the
point is, of course, that if you if you're a master, if you're a grandmaster like Butcheroff was of the topic of analyticity or this chess guy or God, then no matter what's thrown at you, you know how to counter it, right? You know what to do. So let me read just a little more. The Creator's plan of the universe would thus be left blank as to many of its actual details, but all the possibilities would be marked down. The realization of some of these would be left absolutely to chance, that is, would only be determined when the moment of realization came. Other possibilities would be contingently determined, that is, their decision would have to wait until it was seen how the matters of absolute chance fell out. But the rest of the plan, including its final upshot, would be rigorously determined once for all. So the Creator himself would not need to know all the details of actuality until they came, and at any time his own view of the world would be a view partly of facts and partly of possibilities, exactly as ours is now. Of one thing, however, he might be certain, and that is that the world was safe, and that no matter how much it might zigzag, he could surely bring it home at last. But though the wrong seems all so strong, God is the ruler yet, right? God is king, let the heavens ring, or the God reigns, let the earth be glad. That's the idea. No matter how much it zigzags, it'll be brought home. Right?
So I guess you could wade into the problem of evil slightly with that attitude. This is, well, you know, God's letting people run with a little runway there.
Yeah.
Maybe a leash, but, you know, you're not tied to the post.
Yeah. Yep.
And that there will be some evil as a consequence.
Yeah.
But it won't get too bad.
Uh-huh.
Because God is there to rope it back in at some point, I guess you could argue.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the price of some evil in the world because of that?
Could be. Maybe. I mean, I think it is connected
but
to that.
But does he get to...
He has
said almost nothing about evil.
Well, he has.
In his lectures, right?
Well, he has. Just trying to think. I know it's come up.
He's more of an upbeat, he's a fairly upbeat guy in his talks.
True, yeah. But you're certainly right. I mean, this is certainly, it impinges on that whole problem. But it's kind of like a parent, too, as it occurs to me, right? Your kids get older. You give them a certain amount of free space there, and they make mistakes. You just want to make sure they don't make any horrible mistakes. And they learn that way.
But then eventually you lose control.
Oh, yeah, I know. Well, that's true. In that sense, it's a little different. Although, I don't know. I have to tell you the story. This is so dumb. My younger son, he's a great guy, but he's an artist. Maybe that explains a lot, you know.
Oh,
but he borrowed Patty's... He got a new job. They've been living in Philadelphia. He got a new job in Arlington, and they're going to be moving down in a few weeks. Meanwhile, his job started last week, so he's staying with us, but he's going back up to Philly because his wife, her last day is the end of, well, exactly, it's a week from tomorrow. So he went back up there for the long weekend, took Patty's car. Well, he had to get gas. So I'm downstairs. I went to the funeral, you know, and I'm downstairs talking to Liz Helke, and my phone goes off. It's David. And he says, why doesn't the nozzle fit into the gas tank, he says. And I'm saying, what? What are you talking about?
Because the car doesn't take diesel fuel.
Yeah, well, we got going back and forth a little bit. And he says, well, this does take diesel, doesn't it?
Oh,
my cow.
No.
I mean, it's a hybrid. So I guess he thought that hybrids take diesel fuel.
Oh, my God.
And I'm thinking, oh, thank you so much for making this nozzle too big.
Yeah, good design, whoever thought
Oh, my goodness.
Square peg in a round hole.
Yeah. So I said, no, not diesel fuel. And so then he sent me a picture. He said, well, it was a picture of the, you know, 87, 93, 96 on the gas thing. You know, and I texted back 87. So everything was fine. He'll fill the tank with gas. I don't know what would happen if you tried to put diesel fuel into a normal car engine. I'm sure you'd be facing a very pricey repair.
Success breeds hope.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
He's a Ross so, through and
yeah,
through.
Yeah, oh, I'll tell you. Yeah. Anyway, so why did I bring that up? I don't know. We were talking about... parenting, yes. So you say he's 33 or something. I'm still keeping disaster at bay. Well, anyway, so, yeah, I told him I'd have to tell his wife what happened. But then Patty said, no, that would be cruel.
Don't do that.
Absolutely not.
Maybe he did. Who knows? Well, anyway, on to the next topic. So the final topic has to do with, this is from the essay, which is not politically correct these days, Great Men and Their Environment. But anyway, it's kind of interesting. He's talking about civilizational progress and, you know, the so-called great man theory of history. In other words, is history determined by a few really important people who really effect amazing changes? Or is it due to just, I don't know, social forces at large, something like that? Clearly, he's in the former camp, the great man theory of history. I don't know where the term great man theory came from. I don't know if it came from William James or not. But anyway, this is what he says about it. This is also kind of interesting. Now, I affirm that the relation of the visible environment to the great man is in the main exactly what it is to the variation in the Darwinian philosophy. It chiefly adopts or rejects, preserves or destroys, in short, selects him. And whenever it adopts and preserves the great man, it becomes modified by his influence in an entirely original and peculiar way. He acts as a ferment and changes its constitution, just as the advent of a new zoological species changes the faunal and floral equilibrium of the region in which it appears. The mutations of societies, then, from generation to generation, are in the main due directly or indirectly to the acts or the example of individuals whose genius was so adapted to the receptiveness of the moment, or whose accidental position of authority was so critical that they became ferments, initiators of movement, setters of precedent or fashion, centers of corruption, or destroyers of other persons whose gifts, had they had free play, would have led society to another direction. So where he's going with this is, well, I think actually the next sentence says it all. This is just a little encapsulation right here. But the indeterminism is not absolute. Not every man fits every hour. Some incompatibilities there are. A given genius may come either too early or too late. So James's version of the great man idea is it's a sort of a two-way street. I mean, yes, you have to have the genius to effect change, but the time has to be right also. And so if Mozart had been born, you know, 100 years earlier, we would have never heard of him. If Thomas Aquinas had been born 100 years later or 200 years later, we would have never heard of him. He was the wrong man for the wrong time, so to speak, you know. So that's the idea. It's a two-way. Go ahead, Marie.
The term the great man have come from Nietzsche, the Übermensch.
Oh, I don't know really.
Willing to take the bull by the horns and get what he wants and change things like he wants.
Yeah, of course, to change things for one's own benefit in the case of Nietzsche, but not necessarily that way in the case of William James. Yeah, I should look that up. That question just popped into my mind just on the spur of the moment. I can Google it probably. Thus, social evolution is a resultant of the interaction of the two wholly distinct factors. The individual, deriving his peculiar gifts from the play of physiological and infra-social forces, but bearing all the power of initiative and origination in his hands. And second, the social environment, with its power of adopting or rejecting both him and his gifts. Both factors are essential to change. The community stagnates without the impulse of the individual. The impulse dies away without the sympathy of the community. So it's a two-way street. And then, though, a little parting shot about how this actually works. Sporadic great men come everywhere. But for a community to get vibrating through and through with intensely active life, many geniuses coming together and in rapid succession are required. This is why great epics are so rare. Why the sudden bloom of a Greece, an early Rome, a Renaissance is such a mystery. Blow must follow blow so fast that no cooling can occur in the intervals. Then the mass of the nation grows incandescent and may continue to glow by pure inertia long after the originators of its internal movement have passed away. We often hear surprise expressed that in those high tides of human affairs, not only the people should be filled with stronger life, but the individual geniuses should seem so exceptionally abundant. This mystery is just about as deep as the time-honored conundrum as to why great rivers flow by great towns. It is true that great public fermentations awaken and adopt many geniuses who, in more torpid times, would have had no chance to work. But over and above this, there must be an exceptional occurrence of genius about a time to make the fermentation begin at all. The unlikeliness of the concourse is far greater than the unlikeliness of any particular genius, hence the rarity of those periods and the exceptional aspect which they always wear. So bottom line is, you kind of need three things. There are three factors. You need the so-called great man. You need the society to be receptive to that particular form of genius, but you need a bunch of them in quick succession to sort of light things up. And of course, he's thinking about Athens, 5th and 4th century Athens, and it is astonishing, all these names, Aeschylus, Euripides, Sophocles, and Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Demosthenes, you know, Thucydides, you know, holy cow, what is going on? But there it is.
I think they stimulate each other.
Yeah, that's
they
partly
feed,
it.
The stimulation, continuation.
Yeah.
Alone, you wouldn't go there.
Exactly. We all know.
You have to.
Yeah, we all know that success breeds hope. okay, let me give you a little whet your appetite for what's coming up, because we're almost out of time. This is just about perfect. We are going to move into the varieties of religious experience, which is, as I say, I don't know, partly a work in psychology, partly a work in philosophy, partly a work in history, I'd say. But here are the topics we're going to cover starting next week. 6 of them. The nature of religion, that's one. Optimistic versus pessimistic religion. Conversion. Saintliness. Mystical versus rational religion. And finally, what I'm calling James's Neoplatonism, which we had seen evidence of earlier. And that, in turn, will be a segue into the last of the 6 works of James that we're going to cover, which is A Pluralistic Universe, which I title also James's Neoplatonism. So that's how we'll wind up at the end. So that's where we're headed. So be sure to come back, hear about the varieties of religious experience. I know you guys are going on vacation. Okay, starting next week?
On Tuesday.
Next week and the week after, right?
Yeah.
Well, we'll be thinking about you. Where are you going?
We're taking the Queen Mary from New York to about 6 islands in the Eastern Caribbean.
Oh, okay.
So
I see.
Good lectures.
All right.
Dancing, good food, and good bridge.
And warm weather.
Right? I love this cold weather.
Oh, good. Well, okay.
Yes.
All righty. Well, see you everybody next week. Bye bye.
Will they have gambling on the boat?
Do they have what?
Gambling.
They.